Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. This episode features Lord Andrew Cooper, founder of Populous, all-round polling guru and expert, pollster to the Remain campaign, David Cameron's former head of strategy, and he was absolutely brilliant. There are times when I was thinking of this, and I'm sure I've used this analogy before, but it's like being on the best university course in the world, because I get to meet leading political figures and just ask them whatever I want, and they get, I mean, Andrew was out of this world good. It's a brilliant insight into polling, into, I suppose, why mistakes are made and how they're made, how hard it is to actually know whether people are going to vote or how they're going to vote. It's brilliant. And there are so many lessons that come out of it, more than anything. He's such an impressive individual and such a decent and reasonable person. It is, oh man, it's so hard to, because every week it feels like I say this, but it really was, an hour was nowhere near long enough. And particularly with polling, and when you talk to an expert like Andrew, you're talking to people who, the whole time is spent listening to the public. So even obsessives like me get so much from the media, but Andrew is deeply involved on a regular basis on a range of issues of talking directly to the public. There are some brilliant stories that come out of it. And also, quite apart from anything else, his own politics, his own political journey, and huge social changes that are happening here in America that are hugely relevant. It is. I thought, you know what? I didn't go to private school, but this is the sort of conversation that money can't buy. That it was almost like having the best teacher in the world and someone who's really done it. I came away from it so thrilled, which is really important because obviously politics at the moment is in a particular state. I mean, and I think even if you voted, whichever way you voted, even if you don't vote, although I would hope that most people listen to this are more inclined to vote than not. Even if your party is currently in power and even if your side won in the referendum, I think we all accept that politics in general is in a bit of a state, more perhaps to do with the tone of it and actually the economics of the country we're living in and the time in which we're living, that things are in a bit of a funk. So it's just so good to talk to someone and so reassuring that he was really in a very influential role at times in his life, and that is hugely reassuring in terms of the way the country is run, because people like him should be influential. It was just great. I mean, I'm going to stop waffling now and let you enjoy it, but before that, I've got some wonderful guests lined up for the weekly shows. Emily Thornberry is my next guest at the live show at the Other Palace. There are two Christmas specials on the 19th and 20th of December at the Leicester Square Theatre. These are always more raucous. I can't yet announce it, but I'm very excited about who's coming to do it. So you can get your tickets now from the Leicester Square Theatre, should you want to buy them in advance. And also, I'm doing two shows in London of the show that I did at the Edinburgh Festival, Brexit Through the Gift Shop. I'm doing that at the South Bank Centre, which is very exciting, on the 1st and the 5th of December. Tickets are already going very quickly, but you can get you can get tickets for those at southbankcentre.co.uk. I will leave you in the wonderful hands of Lord Andrew Cooper.
So welcome to the show, Lord Andrew Cooper of Windrush.
Thank you.
How should I address you, Lord Cooper or Andrew?
Andrew, please.
Andrew. Is that, when you become a lord, is that something that your friends and family struggle with in knowing what to call you?
People don't know how to respond to it. Close friends just think it's weird. And it is weird, let's face it. And then when you get asked to do it and you're going through all these introductions and they say to you, oh, you must change your passport. And I subsequently discovered most people ignore that, but I didn't. So I dutifully changed my passport, which
Brilliant.
Is an absolute pain in the neck. Ultimate first world problem. On drop down menus, it doesn't give you Lord. So, and I have to, when you're on an aeroplane, the ticket has to say exactly what's on your passport. So I have to be Lord Andrew, the Lord Cooper of Windrush, and it's a nightmare. I wish I hadn't done it.
But it must be quite cool when you're renewing bank cards or anything like that, and you do get to choose Lord on the... Yeah,
I haven't done that. I haven't changed bank
cards,
no.
Because I do sometimes, when I've had to renew, my documents, Lord does appear on some...
some of them, yeah.
Some of them, you think, oh, that must be so cool to be able to click that.
I always do it for my wife when I'm doing it and she's not. I always put Lady for her, but Mr. for me.
And have you got your seals, or whatever they're called? Is that the big... Yeah. It looks like wax, but I think it's porcelain, isn't it? The big red dish that comes in a red box.
In a big red box, yeah. I think it's under the sofa somewhere, I don't know.
That's so cool. It's like keeping an Oscar in the toilet, isn't it? It's kind of... It's a nice way to deal with it. So you were ennobled by David Cameron, is that right?
That's right.
Who you were very close to.
Yeah.
Obviously been talked about quite a lot in the last few weeks, this mooted return to politics. Is that something he's mentioned to you at all?
No, I'd be very surprised.
I'd be shocked if any Prime Minister wanted to come back in a lesser role.
Yeah.
I can understand people going into the House of Lords later on, perhaps, but I was very sceptical of the reports.
Yeah, I'm very sceptical of the reports too.
You had a close relationship with him, not just at Downing Street, but throughout the Remain campaign. So let's just go back to how you ended up being so influential with David Cameron and with British politics in general. You started out really as a member of the SDP.
So I started out as a member of the Labour Party.
No way! What year?
I grew up in a Labour-supporting household. We were all very interested in politics. I was very political from a weirdly young age.
Yes, same.
It literally didn't occur to me. You know, we were Labour, so I joined the Labour Party in 1976 at the age of 13. Was very active in the Labour Party Young Socialists, where I lived in East Surrey, which in those days was Geoffrey Howe's constituency, very
cool,
Tory.
Oh, yeah.
Got the day off school for the 1979 election, running a Labour committee rooms in a safe Tory ward in East Surrey.
So how old would you have been then at the 79 election?
I was not quite 16.
And they let you have the day off school to do
that?
That's really cool.
Isn't it cool? Yeah.
So in 79, which is, by any measure, really, such a significant election for Britain, for the Tories, by 1997, by pre-1997, really, you'd already started going on a bit of a political journey.
Yeah. I then I joined the SDP at university. First day at university, I went up to the SDP student stall, and there stood Danny Finkelstein.
Cool, man. Oh, I love him.
And we've been incredibly close friends ever since. Became very involved in the STP through those very challenging years for the Labour Party. My first job out of university was working for the STP in its policy department, and then I worked directly for David Owen for 2 or 3 years until the STP completely dissolved. Then went to live in America for a few years, watching British politics from afar. Certainly felt in 92, Neil Kinnock versus John Major, I had no discomfort in saying I thought John Major was the right answer. And came back and was part of a form by sort of Social Democrats for Major stunt, which Danny organised. And then went to work with Danny at the Social Market Foundation back in London. And then when he went to work for the Conservative Party, I went with him. He was appointed director of the research department in, I think, 95. He inherited a vacancy for the deputy director of research, who was in charge of the party's private polling, and he persuaded me to go with him. And that's the first time I got involved in polling.
So in terms of it's a fairly incremental journey from the Labour Party of 79 to the Tory Party of that era. But what are the fence posts? What were the things that started to change your mind?
My affinity with Labour in that period was very much actually about the then Labour government, which was the post IMF Labour government facing up to reality. James Callaghan realising that you couldn't spend your way out of recession, and sort of solidarity with that wing of the Labour Party against the left wing of the Labour Party, which subsequently triumphed over it. So the STP seemed like a very small step from that stage.
Yeah.
Became obviously much more, developing much stronger views of my own through that period. And Danny and I discussed this a lot at the time, and when we both then ended up in the Tory party, it felt as if all of the big political issues of the early mid-80s were ones where actually we and most people in the STP, and certainly the Owenite bit of the STP, were basically in agreement with the Conservatives on things like cruise missiles and the miners' strike and big totemic political moments, broadly speaking, on privatisation as well. And so when the STP sort of split, we decided not to go with the Liberal Party as it then was, because we could have done that at the beginning, and we did have a sort of loyalty to David Owen. And in the end, I think we looked at it and thought, what in our minds had been us defining this very, very distinctive way to be just on the centre-left was, if you were anyone else looking at us, obviously we were on the centre-right.
So then how much of a challenge was New Labour to your... not so much loyalty, but I suppose it is loyalty to the Tories at that point.
I think I remember very vividly in the period up to the 97 election within the Conservative Party, we spent vast amounts on research and umpteen hours trying to figure out what was the most coherent attack on Tony Blair's Labour Party. And it ended up in the grotesque chaos of New Labour, New Danger.
Yeah.
But we went through vast different possible arguments. And the one thing which literally never occurred to anybody was that Tony Blair might mean it, and that Tony Blair might actually be what he said he was. And I think if I had understood that, I think if we had understood that, we would have thought very, very differently about it. And actually, during that awful period of the 97 election campaign, if you were a Tory, which Major called it on purpose to be incredibly long because he thought people might change their minds,
yeah.
it was just drawn-out hell. But we used to keep a sort of private count of how many different strategies the Tories used. And actually, John Major's preferred argument was what we called the Coca-Cola strategy, which was Labour just copying us, and if you want those ideas, you want the real thing.
Yeah.
Which was utterly irreconcilable with the argument that New Labour meant New Danger. You couldn't say both that they were dangerous and they're copying us. but we did, and nobody noticed.
Because the big decision at the time in terms of attack was, do you say that this is same old Labour? Yeah. This is a superficial rebrand of hard left politics, or is it a New Labour and a New Danger?
Yeah. That was a central question. Do we try to argue they haven't really changed? All the research said, but they have changed.
Yeah.
So in the end, we decided there's no point trying to persuade people they haven't, because everyone thinks they had. I think, interestingly, we probably didn't think they had. With hindsight, you can clearly see, of course, they had. We were too close to it. But if they changed, there has to be a reason for not voting for them. So, yes, they have changed, but they've changed into something dangerous. Now, nobody at any point could come up with any examples of what that was, or at least in as much as people kept saying, well, the social chapter's really dangerous. Well, if you're the Tory party, you think that. If you're 75% of the electorate, you think, no, it's great. So we never came up with an illustration of why it was dangerous at all.
Interestingly, people on the left would probably agree that New Labour was dangerous, and certain people running the Labour Party now have been, to some extent, vindicated in terms of their position in the party in that regard. New Labour, New Danger as a campaign, though, has become quite fondly remembered. You see, I think someone's done a Jacob Rees-Mogg version after the last referendum and things like that. It's entered a kind of kitsch part of political history, that it was quite a cool slogan. And it was, I mean, at the time, it was a tough attack. It was sinister.
Yeah, it was. And that's what it was trying to do. It was trying to cast Tony Blair and New Labour as sort of sinister people with some undisclosed agenda. They made a political broadcast, yes. which Brian Mulwinnie vetoed, but which explicitly depicted a Tony Blair-like figure selling his soul, giving up his soul to the devil.
It's incredible. Yeah. They showed it on a documentary called The Major Years on BBC Two a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I thought John Major came out of that so well for saying there's no way we could let this be aired.
Yeah.
But it is, it's a Tony Blair sound-alike and a sort of shadow in the corner.
Yeah.
He's saying, go on, promise you'll improve the country.
You don't have to believe it, just say it. But I think that is revealing, because that was an absolutely authentic picture of what the Tory party actually thought about Tony Blair.
Yes.
And the extent to which they didn't understand
what he really was.
What he really was.
And how people felt about him, perhaps, at the time.
Yeah. And therefore about the country and how much the country had changed.
So you find this passion of polling, which I've always been obsessed by, because I just think... what I find really odd about polling in this area that we're in is that so many people are suspicious of it, when it clearly is just, well, maybe you might disagree, but a really handy way of finding out what people think. And obviously, because of New Labour, people think, well, all you do is you commission opinion polls and then you just tell the public what they want to hear.
Yeah.
And it's seen as quite a cynical part of politics. I've always thought it's a really helpful thing to actually spend time, listen to people, and just go beyond headline voting intention and find out about social attitudes and where the country really is. What was it, apart from the job that kind of led you to it, what was it about polling specifically that you found so fascinating?
I mean, I agree exactly with what you say. It's essential for people in politics to spend some time listening to what people in the country of all different types, what matters to them, what they're experiencing, how they're perceiving the whole process of politics. And it does change. It changes the way that you do politics when you do that properly. Far too many people, I think probably particularly in the Tory party, think that it's in some way sort of unprincipled. You know, you're going to the electorate and ask them to tell you what to think, but nobody does that.
So who are those people in the Tory party? Are they the more traditional voices?
Yeah. Disproportionately, probably on the right wing of the Tory party. But when I worked for, after the 97 election, when we made the first really stumbling attempts to sort of modernise the Tory party, when I worked for William Hague, we were attacked for focus group fascism and using focus groups and polls to tell us what to think. And even after 1997, which was the Tory party's worst defeat since 1832, and we went down to 165 MPs, which is way further than Labour ever fell.
Yeah.
It was amazing how many Tory MPs still had the view that there was nothing fundamentally wrong with the Tory party. And we were very criticised for using polling and focus groups to try to play back to them the voter view.
Some hard truths.
Yeah.
And that was that Britain had probably changed in terms of its social attitudes towards things like homosexuality. Socially, Britain had become a more socially liberal country, do you think, in that period?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Britain had become more socially liberal, but also, in a way, some of the liberalism that Margaret Thatcher, economic liberalism as well, that she had unleashed, had lots of consequences in terms of change in the country, and the Tory party had not kept up to date with its view of the country. There's a great... Neil Kinnock, in his famous militant conference speech, quotes Nye Bevan from In Place of Fear.
Yes.
Where Bevan talked about the risk of politicians becoming what he called symbol worshippers. So you have this very sort of clear picture of the country you believe in. But if you don't sort of concentrate, you can miss the fact that actually the reality has changed and you hang on to this vision that you want to be true. But actually, it's just a symbol. It's not any longer what the country is like. And I think that's what had happened to the Tory party.
In terms of how polling has changed in your time involved in it, obviously, there's the internet, so in terms of accessing respondents and things like that, has changed. What are the fundamentals of the industry in terms of how it's changed in the last 30 or so years?
Well, the key is that the mode of research has kept changing. So, you know, in the ancient days, face-to-face was the way you did it. That became increasingly expensive and difficult. Back in 1992, when the polls were wrong...
Yeah.
The inquiry afterwards concluded that one of the reasons that the polls had been wrong was because they were using face-to-face and they should switch to phones at a point when 95% of the electorate had a landline and used it. And so best practice moved on to the phones. When I started doing polling for the Times newspaper back in 2003, we did it all on the phone. You could do over a weekend, you could do a 1,000-sample poll, which was the sort of standards. The response rate was about 1 in 5. So you'd make about 5,000 calls to get 1,000 people to talk to you over a weekend. Gradually, people, you know, the use of landlines has deteriorated. So today, probably, it's more like 1 in 25 rather than 1 in 5. So doing it on the phone has become increasingly costly and difficult. And also, you get these participation biases. So different types of people are harder to get hold of and less willing to do the poll. And you end up with inadvertent bias in your numbers. So busy middle-class professional people are harder to get hold of and less willing to do it. Young people are incredibly difficult to get hold of. So the standard spiel, if someone answers the phone, you say, can I speak to the youngest adult in the household over the age of 18? Because they're the hardest people to find. Now, these days, you know, hardly anybody uses a landline. Hardly anybody answers a phone call when they don't know who it is.
Yeah.
So that and the cost effect have driven more and more polling online. The problem with polling online is that the underlying premise of polling doesn't hold, which is that what you're getting is a random cross-section of the whole country, because you can't randomly email people. The only way you can poll people online is if you assemble a panel of people that you can poll, and by definition, they're atypical, because they're people who've essentially volunteered to be polled on questions of current affairs in a country where most people are defined by the fact they're not scientists but interested in current affairs. And there are attitudinal differences between those who are and those who aren't. And the more often you ask people poll questions, the less typical they become. But that's the nature of the beast online. Is
So what does that mean, the less typical they become, that they get used to being polled and that changes their answers?
Conditioning is the term. One of the most important truths about politics, which you learn very quickly when you do lots of opinion research, is brilliantly captured in Tony Blair's book, where he says words to the effect, the biggest mistake that most politicians make is massively to overestimate how interested most people are in politics.
Yeah.
He said it's a fatal flaw in most politicians, and he said the reason it matters is because it causes politicians to focus on the small picture when they should be focusing on the big picture.
Yeah.
And so if you take a bunch of people who start from a position of not following politics that much, not knowing much, and you make them do polls over and over again, each time you're adding layers of knowledge, they become less and less typical and more conditioned in the answers they give rather than necessarily answering just from the gut or the front of mind.
That's such an important extrapolation of the point that he makes in that book. I remember him saying to me once, and I don't think it was on microphone, that if Question Time was to improve as a TV programme, you would have 40% or 50% or 60% of the audience, people who were sort of generally interested but weren't that tribal.
Yeah.
Because that's where most people are, and it would be less of a, bear pit.
Yeah, so an awful lot of the stuff which completely obsesses Westminster and people like me and probably you who follow this stuff in detail, the sort of hour-to-hour, day-to-day pantomime of politics, the vast majority of people in the country aren't following that at all.
Yeah.
Quite often we're sent out to do focus groups to sort of probe what the voters think of this, that, or the other, and they don't even know it's happened. And it leads to all kinds of confusion. So I remember in the very early days of the Blair government, because the Tory party was still very strongly associated with sort of incidents of sleaze, and when Robin Cook was caught having an affair, in the focus groups, people tied themselves in knots because they thought Robin Cook must be a Tory. Because he was having an affair.
Wow.
But then they think, hang on, but he can't be a Tory because he's in the government. And they pause. But the level of knowledge is so low.
Yeah.
And it's really important for the politicians to start there. And the point about Tony Blair's big picture, small picture point, rather than talking as if people are interested in and following the drama about some particular policy row or something that happened in the House of Commons, you have to pull back and think, what you're doing is telling a story about the values of the party that you're in.
Yes.
And what you're signalling is what kind of people you are, what matters to you, what kind of country you believe in, whose people you're fighting for. And that's what matters, not the minutiae of the point that you're making.
So just in terms of, I don't want to dwell too much on 1992, but 1992 and 2015 really stand out as big tests for the polling industry and the reputation of the polling industry. In 1992, the exit poll was wrong.
Yeah.
And the logic always was that people tell the truth when they've voted and they're coming out, that they've sort of made their peace with it, they're less bashful or shy. So why was the exit poll wrong? Were people still, you know, is that logic broken now, that people actually will lie after they've voted?
No, I think the problem, what was there, was it was a sampling problem.
Okay.
I mean, the difficulty in an exit poll, you know, there are however many thousand polling stations around the country, you can only sample people at some of them. Making sure you pick the right ones so that they add up to a cross-section of the whole country is really hard.
Yes.
What the exit poll now does is it samples the same polling stations as it did last time, sampling roughly through the same process during the day, and it effectively measures the swing in that polling station since last time. And then they've got a very clever formula they use to scale up from their sample set of polling stations to the whole country.
To be able to extrapolate that.
Yeah, but that's why, you know, one of the frustrations of the exit polls here is that in America, they collect vast amounts of data, so we know a lot about who actually voted, why did they vote, what mattered most to them, who changed their minds. In this country, we don't collect any of that. All we get is people come out of the polling station, they replicate exactly what they did, they put a cross in it and a piece of paper and put it in a box, and out of that we can model how many MPs there'll be for each party. We don't get vote share, we don't get gender balances, we don't really know exactly who voted or why.
And in terms of face-to-face versus phone and an internet or text or whatever else techniques are on out there, is there a particular mode which people are more honest with? Because I remember working for the party and people always used to say, oh, people are more likely to tell the truth to your face than they are over the phone.
I mean,
but I'm not sure if that was just folklore.
And I think it slightly depends what questions you're asking, but there are huge differences here. In America, they established this what they call a Bradley effect, where actually people's perception of the, in that case, the race of the person interviewing them on the phone altered their answer to questions. The experiments online have shown that what font you use and what colour the background is can make a difference.
Wow.
We know that quite small differences in question wording make quite a big difference. Again, going back to the point that most people don't have a very high level of interest or awareness.
Yes.
So most people don't have well-developed opinions on most things. And slightly weirdly, out of nowhere, somebody phones you up or sends you an email asking you to give an answer to a question. You'll answer the question in the form that it's put to you. But that doesn't mean necessarily that if it's phrased slightly differently, you wouldn't give a different answer. Or if you have more information and more context, you might change your mind. So most people, their opinions on most things are relatively fluid.
Well, that's a real challenge, isn't it? Focus groups give you a qualitative way instead of a quantitative way of measuring opinion. In terms of picking a focus group, does it depend on the task at hand, on the brief of the client? Or do you have a set way, do you think, right, if it particularly if it's political, that you would want a group of people, you know, what would be a typical focus group for Theresa May to pick if she came to you tomorrow and said, Andrew, I want you to run a focus group for me on how the public think I'm handling Brexit. How would you constitute the people in the room?
I mean, generally speaking, in a focus group, what you would do is you would want to differentiate between the people who are your core supporters, who will have a different view. You need them to be your advocates and so forth, but they'll have it'll be a different conversation. You'll probably want to screen out the people who are your absolute opponents and will never going to agree with you. Most political focus groups probably consist of the middle group, who are your proverbial floating voter.
Yeah.
And you want to know, you know, how are they perceiving this, what have they noticed, when they hear our argument, which they may not have done in whatever news media they use, how do they react to it, what are the obstacles to it, what are the kind of flaws in the logic that they think are there, what are the proof points that they need that we haven't given them. So a lot of the focus is actually on understanding what's cutting through and on language and how to construct an argument.
So in terms of the types of people you would look for, if Theresa May would say, right, I want a group of people that are swing voters, would you try and have it gender balanced? Would you try and have it as a rough cross? Would it proportionally match
what you generally do?
The UK?
I mean, remember that a focus group is basically, it's 8 or 10 people in a room. So firstly, you need to do several of them. Otherwise, you've just got random 8 or 10 people. You don't know if it means anything. You generally speaking, do 2 groups per evening. And in a wave of groups, you might go to 3, 4, 5 different places. So you select the places quite carefully.
Yeah.
Different parts of the country, different types of constituency.
Nuneaton and places.
Yeah. And you do often end up going to the same marginal seats over, you know, I mean, Watford, Bury, you know, over and over again. We generally split them by gender because men and women do tend to notice different things and talk differently about them.
So you'd have a male group and a female group?
Yes. And if you do, sometimes you have to mash them together, and you definitely do lose, I think, some of the difference in the way that they speak.
Why is that? Is that because men are more dominant?
Men tend to talk more. I think initially, if you look at any opinion poll on a topical question, if you look at the people who say don't know, invariably there are far more women than men saying don't know.
Roughly what proportion is there?
I mean, probably twice as many usually.
Women. So 66% would be women if I don't know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which I've always... It's not because women know less. It's because women, I think, in general terms, much more comfortable just saying, actually, I don't know. Men tend to sort of bluff out of you. And I think... And you do see the same thing in focus groups where men will tend to kind of dive in.
Wow, isn't that fascinating?
But certainly, I mean, you know, we very frequently have a two-hour conversation with a bunch of men and a bunch of women, and they're very different conversations. And certainly if you want to know what's cutting through and the language to use and what aspects of issues are concerning people... It's better done as a separate conversation.
And what are there any characteristics that define those conversations? What are the things that women tend to say or care about versus men?
Women tend to be more talkative. Men tend to, I think, particularly if men are conscious of the fact they don't actually, because it's a very weird artificial environment. And quite often at the end of them, people say that's the longest conversational politics I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
And people, I mean, we also have to emphasise at the beginning, this absolutely is not a general knowledge quiz. This isn't about how much you know. We're just interested in what people have noticed and what they think, because people suddenly become very self-conscious that they actually don't think they know as much as they thought they did before they came into the room. And I think that tends to manifest itself more in men who tend not to want to say something if they're not, so they're worried about revealing that they don't know much.
Wow. And is that must be quite hard to manage sometimes. I mean, do these things ever get heated?
Occasionally, not usually, because most, if it's a representative group of typical voters, most of them, they're unlikely to feel very strongly about anything. And the way we would recruit, I mean, if you take Brexit, for example, we, in order to understand properly the different sides of the argument, you're not going to get that if you put four diehard Remainers and four diehard Leavers in the room. You're just going to have an argument and shouting at each other. Yeah. So we would separate out on big issues like that where there may be deeply held views. But on a lot of day-to-day political issues... Most people just don't feel strongly enough to have an argument with each other.
In terms of a snapshot of where we are now as a country, as a United Kingdom, what would you say the social attitudes of Britain are, and have they changed much in the last 20 years?
I mean, I take comfort in the fact that the big picture is that Britain is becoming a much more progressive, much more socially liberal country over time. And the evidence is it will continue to do so, but clearly, at the moment we are deeply, deeply divided on a set of very broad attitudes, values, worldviews in a way which is actually quite scary, and roughly 50-50 division with a very strong age divide within it, and two views of the world that are completely irreconcilable, and two groups of people who don't understand how each other can view the world in the way that they do.
And within that, let's just say for the last sort of 20 years, has concern about immigration risen significantly since 1998?
Yes, it has. And Ipsos Mori published some analysis a few years ago showing actually a concern does, broadly speaking, track with the increase in numbers. I think a lot of that is to do with the way that it's reported.
Yeah.
I mean, it is one of the defining facts of the Brexit referendum that the places that were the strongest support for Brexit are by and large places where there isn't any immigration. They are absolutely defined by their lack of diversity,
yes.
Whereas the most diverse places were the strongest Remain areas. So the concern about immigration in its political impact is by and large something which is observed rather than experienced, and therefore the way that it's reported and the way that over a period of years people have concluded that it somehow accounts for so many problems in our country isn't based on actually something which they're experiencing in their own communities.
In terms of Britain as an ideological country, is there any evidence that people are becoming when you think of the relative popularity of Labour, if not Corbyn, although it's obviously under his leadership, is there any evidence that, that British people are becoming more left-wing or more socialist?
No, I don't think so. I think what we're seeing is more and more people feeling that the status quo doesn't work for them. And without necessarily subjecting to a huge amount of scrutiny the specifics of what are being suggested as alternatives, just a desire to look for something else, look for something different, a desire really to kind of tip the system on its head because it's not working, to shake up the establishment, the mainstream, make them deal with the problems that don't seem to be being dealt with, rather than necessarily a very sort of deep or considered view that the specific way in which they're proposing to do it is the right way.
Well, that's a very concerning message for the current leadership of the country. Do you get a sense that they're tuned into that as a message, that there is a discord out there that has already created chaos in the political system and could indeed wreak more havoc?
I think that most politicians underestimate how deep that goes and how far that runs. And I think this is one of the big messages of the Brexit referendum, unless the mainstream properly listens and engages with the things about people's experiences in their lives that have caused them to lose confidence in the status quo, to lose confidence in the political system, to lose faith that they really have a stake in the success of the country, then the politics continues to go off to the extremes.
And how much of this is post-crash and how much of that was around before?
I think it's a process which started before. You can see it in the data, actually. It started, I think, hopes in Tony Blair, I'm hugely positive by and large about Tony Blair, by the way, but hopes in Tony Blair were ludicrously, unmeetably high.
Yeah.
And I think the moment people sort of started to look at his government and think, why hasn't it fixed everything? And the sense, you know, this huge majority, he could do anything and things weren't, you know, from different perspectives, different views people had about what those problems were, but that you saw a sort of decay starting. I think the MP expense scandal was a massive, massive issue. It was a kind of gotcha moment for a lot of people.
Yeah.
They were shocked, but they weren't surprised. You know, sort of, we always suspected that secretly that's what they were up to.
Yeah, but they had it confirmed.
Yeah. Which enabled people to just lump all politicians together. They're all basically the same. They're all in it for themselves. They're on the other side of this gulf between them and us. They've all got their snouts in the trough. And then the banking crash, where the same sort of people, you know, the elite in whose interest everything seemed to work, brought this completely incomprehensible mess down on our heads, and then were never held to account for it. And carried on behaving basically in the same way almost straight away and carried on with the access to power that they had, and while everybody else in the country had to pay the price for that in a decade of austerity. I think you can understand why people feel... And then, you know, unknowingly, what we did, with hindsight, in the referendum campaign on the Remain side was produce a parade of those same people saying... You know, stay in the EU, it's good. And I think people were saying, well, we know it's good for you. We know it works for you. It doesn't work for us. That's the point, and you're not listening.
In terms of putting this in context, because depending on who you talk to in politics, some people say, well, politicians have always been at the bottom of the League of Trust. There have always been events that have, whether recessions or the poll tax or whatever they are, the miners' strike, these big moments of political unrest that have destroyed trust. Is this a new type of... relationship, though? Are we seeing something more profound in this era?
I think so. There are occasions in the past things have happened and people have lost trust in some politicians. As a category, people didn't have as little faith as they have now, little trust as they have now in politicians in general, parties in general, in government in general, as they do now. I think in the past people tended to sort of think they were bad apples rather than thinking that the whole system is rotten. That's partly because of things which have happened in politics. I think it's partly just because the way that the world has changed and the way that everybody, we're now, you know, bombarded with information about everything, and the way we feel about every transaction we undertake has changed. We feel more empowered. and we're more critical. People have become more and more cynical. So, you know, nobody believes anything anyone says. It's show me. And you get this kind of reinforcing cynicism about everything, but you just, you know, need a few big proof points to make people feel that it's not working. Now, I think history will pull back and say this is all a massive reaction to globalisation.
Yeah.
And the massive economic and then a political dislocation stemming from the economic dislocation and how mainstream politics did or didn't handle it. But we're right in the middle of it.
So is there any hope that this relationship can change, that there are politicians or answers to realign or reconnect the political class? I mean, to some extent, Jeremy Corbyn provides a hope in that regard, doesn't he? That he has managed to energise people who were previously cynical about politics or traditionally cynical.
Yes, he does. He does seem to have done that. He has an ability to connect with people. I think that's more to do with it's more to do with the fact that he seems to be an authentic person. It's more to do with the fact that he comes across as somebody who has consistent principles. Someone said in a focus group recently, "Thing about Corbyn, he's never changed his mind on anything for 30 years." Yeah. But they meant it as a good thing. and almost, this is an exaggeration, but it's almost that people don't mind that much what it is he believes. It's that he believes something. He's not one of those politicians, which is the caricature people have, unfairly, by the way, but have of most politicians, which is they don't really believe in anything. They don't mean what they say. They don't try to do what they say. They're telling you what you want to hear. They're reading out some speech written by somebody. They're giving you a soundbite that someone's written for them. They don't mean it. So the only politicians who anybody even slightly is drawn to are the politicians who come across as authentic, unspun. You know, there's an element there of kind of gaff prone, but unscripted. They mean what they say, and that's the appeal of Boris Johnson. That's the appeal of Jeremy Corbyn. It was the appeal of Ken Livingstone in his pomp.
Yes.
Anne Widdecombe, Mo Molem, Ken Clark. The only politicians people warm to are people who come across in that way, and those characteristics actually matter more in their ability to be heard and sort of liked than what they're actually saying.
So if you are a career politician or an Oxbridge conveyor belt, well, I'm trying to think of the other insults that people hurl around about some very talented individuals, but if you are of that kind of generation or of that style, what is the lesson to take from that then? To actually be less uptight, be more yourself?
Yes, I think people in politics have got massively sort of over-obsessed with sound bites and make sort of make everybody use the same language. You know, any ordinary person, when they hear a obviously prepackaged soundbite coming out, they switched off before it's even halfway out of your mouth. You know, you have a clear argument, but everybody should express it in their different ways that's authentic to them, in their own language. I think also it drives people nuts that politicians don't give a straight answer to a straight question. They don't say "I don't know" when "I don't know." They don't say "Actually, the other lot have got quite a good point there." the idea that this sort of absurd tribalism that only we are right about anything and they are wrong about everything, that just drives people nuts.
So I suppose in a way people just have to be a bit more mature.
Yes.
That's all it would require. It's not about necessarily big policy ideas. These are stylistic, cosmetic. They come from a pure truth. Yeah.
But I think if politicians behave in the way that almost every other institution in this country now behaves, I mean, if you think about how Parliament is and the way that they shout at each other.
I like that.
But it's incredibly unhealthy. I was at school with Keir Starmer.
No way!
He's an old friend of mine. And he said to me, we had lunch a little while ago, and he said he's ready to do his first speech at the dispatch box. he's joined the shadow cabinet. And a massive moment in someone's career. He hasn't long been an MP. And so he's sitting there a bit nervous, draws breath, stands up, puts his papers down on the box, looks up, and he said, and there's 200 people shrieking at you. Now, there is no other institution in Britain where that would be acceptable any longer. And it's no surprise now that we're now seeing all kinds of issues coming to the surface about the way that people treat each other in politics. But, I personally think some of the process and the pageantry and the tradition is part of the problem because it enables it to be opaque to people and people hide behind the bluster. But it's unsurprising that it doesn't lead to edifying, sensible, serious discussion.
That's a fair point, but there is something about the cauldron of it that is enticing, particularly when you compare it to other parliaments. There is it's a ferocious arena that probably does improve politicians to an extent.
It means that in order to succeed, you have to have that skill set. You have to be quick witted. You have to be very clear about what you're going to say, because of course you can't hear anything in there.
No.
I'm not sure that it adds much, though, positively to the way that the country's run. And I think it's part of the reason why politics doesn't work.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
In terms of 2015, then, because we talked about 1992, 2015, to many people, was a huge shock, particularly to the Lib Dems, who didn't see that route through the Southwest being carved underneath their feet. And the book, I think it's Tim Ross's book about 2015, is a brilliant Why the Tories Won, or something like that. How the Tories Won It, I think it's called. Was 2015 a shock to you?
Yeah. I think it was a shock to everybody. Some people after the fact said that they knew, but I'm not sure that anybody did. 2015, the error of the polls reveals the other big problem that polls have, which I'm not quite sure how this is solved, which is, even assuming that you can, by whatever mode, phone or online or whatever, you can get a sample of people that's genuinely representative of the whole country, and that's really hard, you're left with the problem, how do we know who's going to vote?
Yes.
People are massive... likely to overstate their own likelihood to vote. There's a social norm effect. You're meant to vote, so people say, oh, I always vote. But you don't. we know that probably in our sample of 2,000 people, about 70%, give or take, are going to vote. Which 70% vote makes all the difference in the world, particularly in times where the difference between the two main parties is within the margin of error anyway. And people overstate their own likelihood. So in the old days, pollsters always used to just ask, on a scale of 0 to 10, how likely are you to vote? And then they would weight the answer to the voting question in direct proportion. But post-election polls and the studies between elections, where you re-poll the same people, show that was incredibly inaccurate.
And actually,
people who say that they're 10 out of 10 likely to vote tomorrow, a lot of them don't. And quite a lot of people who say, I'm only 3 or 4 out of 10 likely to vote, do. So then most polls are switched to what they call propensity models, which is where you discount how likely people say they are to vote, and you look at recent previous elections, and you can say, we know that people of certain particular demographic groups have a greater or lesser likelihood to vote. So the more demographic information we know about you, the more confidently we can infer how likely you are actually to vote, without even asking you.
And is that more accurate?
Well, the problem with it, it looked accurate for a while, but the problem is it varies from election to election. So I think I'm getting this the right way around, I think in 2015 that was more accurate, but in 2016, a year later, that was the biggest source of error in the referendum polls. The people who in 2015 were the most right were the most wrong in 2017. So you're basically left guessing who's going to vote. My company, we've stopped doing voting intention polling partly for this reason. But in 2017, I think there were 16 different polling organisations produced a final vote prediction. I think the evidence is they were looking at roughly the same raw data, and the spread of numbers they published was between a 16% Tory lead and 3% Labour lead.
Wow.
And all of that spread is their different estimation of who's actually going to vote. So, you know, in all the debate now about people's votes and if there are a second referendum, the truth is a huge amount will depend upon who actually votes this time. In 2016, there were about 2 million people who came out and voted who hadn't voted in the general election a year earlier, and many of those people had never voted before, but Brexit was an issue which animated them. Will they come out again? We don't know. We know that a lot of them didn't come out again a year after that in the 2017 general election. 2016, we'd expected a lot of young people who tend usually not to vote, to vote. But actually, we overestimated that, and a lot of them went onto the electoral register, we know that, but and then didn't end up voting. Will they vote next time if there was a people's vote? We don't know.
So in terms of demographically, that 2 million people, young people are less likely to vote, so they're in there. Are we talking also about white working class people? What's the what's the rest of the constitution of that 2 million?
They were the two broad groups, and in the 2016 referendum, in the end, there were far more, crudely speaking, white working class people who don't usually vote, who voted, than there were 18 to 24s. We know that, and one of the causes for poll error in the referendum was, we know, because the data was published, that of the people who signed on to the electoral register in order to be able to vote, those people were very disproportionately younger. There were more than twice the proportion of 18 to 24s in that group than there were in the population, which is why the Remain campaign was confident a lot of those people were going to come out. Now, the evidence is actually a lot of them, having gone on to the electoral register to be able to vote, then didn't. Whereas huge numbers of people, older white working class people who don't usually vote, did come out and vote.
So you were doing the polling for the Remain campaign,
yeah,
which must have been an incredible experience. I'm not sure that quite covers what you went through. I mean, in terms of seeing the results come in on the night, seeing Sunderland and Newcastle early and extrapolating from that, did you know you'd lost at that point?
Yeah. Interestingly, on this particular issue, on Brexit, the demographics are an incredibly strong predictor. So you can predict whether someone is a Remain or Leave voter on the basis of just 4 or 5 bits of demographic information. And because we know the underlying demographics of each local authority area where they were being counted, once we knew where the baseline was, you could predict incredibly accurately. In fact, we built a model that you put in the results from the first few and it predict the end result, and it didn't change after the first 3 or 4. So we knew.
And in terms of how polling influences a campaign, you're obviously taking the opinion of the nation. It's then up to the campaign to react to that information. I don't know if you've read Tim Shipman's book, All Out War.
I started it and I couldn't bring myself to.
I can imagine it's very hard.
For a lot of people who were closely involved in the Remain campaign, it's still an incredibly emotional, sort of raw thing. It's very weird. I know people who are close friends who haven't fallen out with each other but just can't talk to each other anymore because it's still such an emotional thing.
I found it hard just as a voter, let alone someone who'd been close to the campaign. So I can't imagine how it would feel to read it from your perspective. But in the book, they talk about polling and the margin of error and things like that. And there's almost not a suggestion that it was the cause of the defeat, but that had the polling been different or done in a different way, perhaps the campaign would have been run differently. I mean, do you think it would have changed fundamentally the stronger in campaign at all?
I don't think so. I mean, it goes to how polling is used within campaigns, and because it's the currency people are sort of used to in the media, people tend to focus on the voting intention bit, and that's not at all the most important bit of it. Actually, the Remain campaign polling was wrong. It wasn't far off, but it was off. And the final, about the last two and a half weeks, we had it basically within the margin of error of 50-50, but with Remain slightly ahead. I think there was definitely a conceptual mistake made, which I don't think made a difference in terms of what the campaign did, but we had assumed that people who were undecided right to the end, if they voted, would break in favour of Remain as the least risky option, because that's what's happened in literally every referendum there's ever been anywhere on anything, including the recent experience in Scotland. And actually that didn't happen. So we sort of assumed if it's 50-50 going in, it will just about be OK. But we knew it was very close. I mean, the key bit of the what the research is doing in the campaign is really its triage from the outset. And we first, you know, with the bare bones of that campaign were done, the big segmentation exercise where we're going to deconstruct the election was done in March the previous year. But what you're doing is asking a lot of really detailed questions, not just about the specific issue of the EU and the UK's membership of it, but much broader questions about how people feel about globalisation, internationalism, immigration, a whole range of values questions. Yes. And then you split the electorate into segments that are alike attitudinally, regardless of their demographics or region or anything else. You end up with a series of discrete groups that are alike and different from each other. And then you triage. So you're saying, well, actually, there's two groups here who basically, they've already made up their minds. There's nothing we can say to those people to get them to vote to Remain. There's two groups here, they're going to vote to Remain whatever. They're not going to change their mind. We need to make sure that they're motivated. We need to get out the vote operation. They need to be our advocates. And then there's a group in the middle, two groups in the middle. They're the people who are genuinely in play here. They're the people we focus on. And from that point on, really, all of the research, because there's tons of published research telling you what the horse race is nationally, what the campaign's research is doing is focusing on the people who are the focus of its campaigning to try to understand how they're feeling about this, what they're hearing, what's weighing them, what their reservations are, what are the arguments which we could make to them which they would find persuasive. And you know, those are the groups among whom we lost. They started off, you know, if you really pushed them, if you said the referendum's right now and you can't abstain, what are you going to do? They were leaning narrowly Remain. And at the end, the majority of those people went to Leave. And my view is it's fundamentally about that we lost the economic argument. Mm. Lots of people focus on immigration, and throughout that campaign, and particularly for the last few weeks, almost every day, a debate was had about should we directly engage the issue of immigration, to which my view was yes, if we got something to say. But the fact was that David Cameron had said, I won't take no for an answer on free movement, and then he took no for an answer on free movement. Mm. And the fact was, voting to remain in the EU meant the continuation of free movement. Now, personally, I'm quite happy to make an argument in favour of free movement, but that was unlikely to win. And for people who are concerned about immigration, if the choice is leave and have total control or remain and have no control and have free movement, that wasn't a great position. Mm. What the research said, and I see no reason to think this wasn't true in principle, was there were enough people who thought that immigration was a really important issue and were for that reason drawn to the idea of leaving, but who were also persuadable that the economics, both the benefits of staying in and the risks of leaving, trumped that immigration concern. And without an economic argument to deploy, we had to build a campaign on economics, and we had to say we are better off in the EU and we'd be worse off leaving. And it was a very transactional message, but the voters we were aiming at were very transactional in their feelings. Mm. We call them the hearts for your heads, because about 80% of them said, my heart says we should leave the European Union, my head says I'm really worried about the risks of leaving the European Union. But I think the way in which the campaign tried to paint the picture of what those risks were, some of it I think was disproportionate, and it looked hysterical, but in the totality, actually, the way in which we were doing it was principally by reference to, you know, esteemed expert international bodies and acronyms you'd never heard of, or a parade of, as I was referring to earlier, you know, business people and other people who the rest of the world thinks, you know, already knew, thought the EU worked. Actually, we were in a sense making the other side's argument for them. We knew right from the beginning that. If in people's minds the question was how do we get more control as a country, we were going to lose. We tried to make an argument that we're all better off, though the EU is a flawed institution and though we have frustrations about immigration, the solution to those isn't to bust the economy. And we just failed to persuade people of that argument.
One of the things that comes out of the book is this view, and I think it's one that Dominic Cummings puts forward, the idea that actually immigration was an economic argument, that it wasn't necessarily concern about different people coming here. It was about job security, and actually they'd weaponised immigration in an economic way.
Yeah, no, I think that's completely true. One of the things which we tracked during the referendum campaign was a very simple question which said, if the UK ends up leaving the EU, do you think the following things will go up or down? And there were things like immigration, unemployment, NHS waiting lists and so on. And what it told you was that by a massive margin, people thought if we leave the EU, immigration from the EU will go down. So will immigration from other countries. But unemployment will go down because they won't be coming here taking our jobs. Mm. The benefit bill will come down because they won't be here coming here taking our benefits, which weirdly people think they do as well as taking our jobs. NHS waiting lists will go down. Council house waiting lists will go down. Class sizes will go down. Less trade with the EU, but more trade with the rest of the world. And so it was immigration was the sort of magic bullet solution to so many problems people saw in the country. As I say, principally, not exclusively, but principally people in places where there wasn't any immigration, observing its effect on our country and concluding an awful lot of the problems we have with public services and with the things that matter in our lives and the pressures on our country, which is so overstretched, seem to originate here. So I think the Leave campaign was incredibly smart. I think it was deeply cynical and deeply dishonest, but incredibly disciplined. I think they deployed immigration in a profoundly disreputable but very effective way. I think the way that they played Turkey as an issue was profoundly wrong and dishonest and actually very unpleasant.
Michael Gove said I'm not sure he's used the word apologise, but he said he might have done things differently on Turkey.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, Michael Gove knew perfectly well why David Cameron would be wrong to say we'll veto Turkish entry. Boris Johnson, who was one of the most prominent advocates of Turkish accession, and has himself got Turkish heritage. But, you know, then the linkage with that by the geography that Turkey isn't, you know, Turkey's near Iraq and basically it's a gateway for, you know, it was very, very, it was outrageous scaremongering. I think the other very clever linkage they made was with the NHS. Mm. As I say, what our polling told us, people make that direct link. People think that if we leave the EU and therefore control our borders, they'll put less pressure on the NHS and waiting lists will go down. We tried to respond to that by pointing out how much the NHS depends upon people who work in it, who come from other countries. But that was very powerful, and so the £350 million a week was an incredibly effective way to you know, a benefit that linked, that felt credible to people. It was, you know, we know it was a lie. We know it was a very cynical thing to say. You know, they stuck to it doggedly, which is admirable discipline in the campaign. But it's, you know, it's very clear now that we're not going to see £350 million a week for the NHS, and it just wasn't true, and they knew it wasn't true.
You'd been director of strategy to David Cameron prior to the referendum campaign, and then you end up being very close to him during the referendum campaign in a polling capacity. How did it affect him having people like Boris and Michael Gove saying those sort of things and declaring war on him when he was clearly reluctant to declare war on them?
I mean, I think the thing about David Cameron is that I think what everyone thinks of his politics, he's temperamentally very well suited to be a political leader. And I was always amazed. I worked for him for over 2.5 years in Downing Street, and I worked for him and with him before and since. And he's amazingly calm, and he's very good at not getting emotional about things. I think it's clear from the sort of contemporary histories that he was very upset at Michael Gove's position, I think, because he felt that their relationship was of a different nature, and I think he felt that there were at least implicit understandings between them, that if Michael took that position, he wouldn't take that position very visibly or vigorously. Yeah. And I think Michael Gove ended up saying things which, in the cold light of day, he wouldn't have said or thought. I think everybody always makes discounts for Boris. I personally don't, but a lot of people do. And that was just Boris. I mean, we knew it was very clear. Indeed, it was clear in the public polling. If you look back at the polls back in the autumn of the previous year, polls clearly showed that if David Cameron comes back from negotiations and he and Boris Johnson agree this is a good deal and we should vote to remain, the massive bulk of Tory voters would were going to take the party line on that and back them. And in the scenario that Cameron comes back and says this is a good deal, back it, and Boris Johnson says no, we should leave, we lost all bounce and all party advantage. So we knew that it was a big discriminator, and David knew that, but he was very phlegmatic about it.
How did he take bad news? And compared to some of the other politicians you've worked for, Major and Owen and people like that, when you're delivering the words of the public to them, you know, how do some of the people that you've worked for differ in their capacity to take, I suppose, in a way, quite insulting messages from focus groups?
Yeah, I think I've probably been quite lucky. I think everyone I've had the task of reporting those things to have taken it very well. I mean, David Cameron had a kind of masochistic desire to be told the full detail of what people think, and sometimes then he would get quite sort of self-righteous and say, but that's not right, but I'm not. You know, the people think he's completely out of touch, and the truth is he wasn't. You know, he lives a different life because he's a politician and so on, but in terms of what people meant by that, which is he doesn't understand the kind of challenges we face, and he doesn't understand the things we care about. Well, actually, I think as much as a politician can, he did. He insisted upon, partly I think that one reads that Gordon Brown's pulses used to have to sort of edit because he would throw things at them. And David, he wanted to know, and one of my jobs when I worked for him was he wanted sort of an unvarnished view of what people are saying and thinking about him.
And would you use the words that were used in focus groups? I mean,
yeah,
because these things often find their way into the newspapers, yeah. And they're very insulting.
Yeah,
when they're likened to animals, or yeah. I remember one exchange between Haig and Blair during that golden era of Prime Minister's Question Time, where they'd got hold of the same polling report, and Haig gets what he said. 29% of people wouldn't buy a used car of him. 49% of him think he's a liar. And he's just throwing these. Yeah. I remember Blair saying, I notice he hasn't used the words used about him. 48% of people think he's a drip. Such a funny exchange about the words people associate with him.
I mean, I've always, you know, they're the real words, and often people come up with the most vivid ways of making a point. I've always felt actually getting politicians to engage with something is helped usually by playing back exactly the language people use. I remember, back in the Hague era, when we first sort of trying to put forward a modernising argument, and I remember doing an lecture to him in 1998 saying, basically, the focus group view can be summed up by, they just say, they've got to get rid of Hague. You know, people thought William was deeply weird because they remembered that he'd been a Tory when he was 16.
Yes.
And like he'd almost sort of grown in a test tube in the basement of Tory central office and unleashed on Britain. The language people use is a very effective way to bring it to life. And most politicians respond well to that, in my experience.
Well, that's good because you mentioned Gordon there. I mean, certainly some politicians that I'd worked for or been around over the years, I was strangely allergic to public opinion, I thought, and almost didn't want to listen to what... I mean, not just in terms of not wanting to listen, but were very reluctant to talk to the public face-to-face. Yeah. And I can think of two or three MPs in marginal seats that were lost in 2010 that would never go out and canvass opinion in their constituency because they were so petrified of the public. It's just a straight... to me, a politician was always someone who was comfortable with the public, but actually my experience started to teach me something very different.
Yeah, no, not all of them are. And they have different reactions. I remember also once in a Hague shadow cabinet meeting presenting some polling and John Redwood saying, who was then shadow, whatever he was, he said, I do my own polling every Friday on the doorsteps of my constituency, and let me tell you, that isn't what people think. He said, oh, my God. But no, in my experience, most politicians respond quite well to it. I think when you get them to go to folk groups, which I always try to encourage them to, they were always utterly shocked and appalled by how little people knew. I remember after Boris Johnson resigned from as MP for Henley to go and run for Mayor of London, and there was a by-election, and we did some focus groups, and I remember Chris Grayling, who was Shadow Home Secretary, I think, but he wanted to come and watch them, and he insisted that he'd be kind of sneaked in through the back door because people would identify him. And and the groups were on a Monday night, and as it happened, he spent the sort of weekend on the weekend programmes making some spurious announcement or other. So, you know, he thought, well, they're all going to be. And he was absolutely heartbroken because, you know, we all start by, you know, what have you noticed in the news? And he, you know, he's expecting them all to, oh, well, Chris Grayling was saying. And then, but the truth is they never heard of Chris Gray. They couldn't pick him out of a police lineup. They've got no idea he was on telly or what it was like. He was heartbroken. But that reality check is really important for politicians, I think. Going back to the Blair point about the big picture.
It's so important. In terms of polling now, then, and its role and what populist provides, because there are so many, Ipsos Mori, as it now is, people fondly remember Gallup, and these parts, particularly of election night TV, or general election campaigns, where polling comes under the microscope again, and the Comres and all these other companies. Are you all distinct in the way that you gather data and use it? And what does, I suppose it's asking you to pitch your own company, but what does populist do that other polling companies don't?
We no longer do traditional voting intention polling because my view is the reasons why it's been wrong are not really fixable. So we tend to use more sophisticated and bigger data sets, demographic data, other data, and analytics to try to make sense of what people are doing and to some extent to enable you then to kind of predict where they're going rather than... I think the truth is that the traditional vote intention question is just a really crap product. And actually, the way that people live their lives these days, getting hold of a representative sample of people who are willing to give you several minutes of their time to answer your questions is really difficult. And as people have become less and less adherent to particular parties and more people sort of in the churn of feeling cynical and not sure and looking for something else, people's answer to the question, how would you vote if there was an election tomorrow, isn't really worth anything. So to really understand it, you need to do much more detailed kind of analysis. I think, there are lots of polling companies out there, and we all use the same basic modes to collect the data. There are only so many ways you can interview 1,000 people, 2,000 people, whatever. Depending on the clients we have, you may be asking different types of people, you're asking different kinds of questions. And I think all the companies are now using more sophisticated techniques to try to make sense of it. The 2017 election, the innovation was what they call multi-level regression and post-stratification, which was a technique which YouGov introduced, where they did, if you remember, they continued to publish their traditional polls, but they did the work for The Times, which was the first to predict there was going to be a hung parliament, and everyone thought, blimey. But it was broadly right. But that's using very large data sets and basically sort of deconstructing back down to the building blocks and rebuilding each constituency in sort of replica. But then that predicted, for example, that Canterbury was going to go Labour, which looked unthinkable. And in an election where all of the top-line polls were saying actually the Tories are way ahead, the sophisticated data stuff was saying they're probably not.
So what's the relationship like between polling companies? Because you're simultaneously colleagues and rivals, aren't you? Is there a sense that you share best practice, or do you jealously guard your secrets?
No, it's a fairly small and fairly friendly universe, and there's competition as well. So the world of polling sort of changed fundamentally in 1992 when the polls were wrong, and a series of methodological innovations were developed in order to respond to the reasons why the polls were wrong in 92. But what they amounted to was stepping over a line beyond simple statistical sampling to a degree into modelling, the introduction of different weights to try to make sure the sample is representative, which involve a degree of educated guesswork. Mm. And the sort of standard in the polling industry since then has been actually... there isn't a provable correct way to do this. The way that society changes, the way that modes of communicating with people change mean that that's constantly fluid, and something which worked the last election won't necessarily work at the next one. So we all have to innovate. And what we hold ourselves to is a standard of transparency. So there's an organisation set up called the British Polling Council, which all the main polling companies are members of. And what that does is it has rules of transparency. So we have to publish all of our data and what we've done to it. We have to say which weights we've applied to this data to try to make it a more representative sample. People do that in different ways. We all publish it, and we're all ultimately answerable for who turns out to be right. But hopefully that sort of pooling of knowledge, in a sense, and testing by experimentation and by other people testing their theories, we end up with an innovative industry, and we do respond to those challenges.
What's your view on the idea that opinion polls aren't just a snapshot of opinion, but they can help lead opinion? And there's been a discussion about this coming out of Trump's election and the EU referendum and other elections as well, that actually polls themselves influence the public to vote one way or the other.
I think it's hard to argue that that's wrong. I mean, yeah, there will certainly be people who will see a headline saying that, you know, Leave is going to win or Remain is going to win, who may think, either, well, I'm not going to bother to vote then, there's no point, or I'm definitely going to vote then.
Yes.
I think it's quite hard to quantify. I'm not sure there's anything we can do about it in the internet era. I mean, in France, they used to ban polls for 2 weeks before elections, and that was held to be in contravention of Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights, and now they have a voluntary ban for the last 24 hours. But actually, in the internet era, there's nothing you can do from stopping somebody in the world from doing a poll and putting it on the internet somewhere. And the other argument about that is that in democracy, it's better to have a kind of a symmetry than an asymmetry of information. And if you do ban it or restrict it, what you do is create a world in which the people who do know what's going on are banks and hedge funds.
Yes.
Rather than ordinary people.
Well, that's another. I mean, I was going to talk about the Scotland referendum and the poll that shook Westminster, or not quite on the eve of the vote, but certainly very close to it. But as you talk about banks and hedge funds, there's discussion about Nigel Farage and his behaviour on referendum night to concede early. And that is suggested perhaps could have caused movement in the markets, but that actually he'd seen polling that suggested they were fine. Is that the sort of thing that you would worry about the implications of?
Yeah, well, the Treasury Select Committee is looking at this, and the Financial Conduct Authority, or one of those bodies, is looking at this. I mean, during the referendum, very substantial sums of money were paid by financial institutions to run private polls, exit polls, in order to get a march on the result, because that referendum was clearly an event which was going to move markets around the world, and therefore the opportunity to make and lose money. I don't think we know what the effect was. I don't think we know if money actually was then sort of bet on those things. And so there's speculation that some people may have intentionally tried to manipulate markets. I don't think there's any evidence to support that, but it certainly in big electoral events like that, which can move markets, hedge funds and other financial sector institutions do spend a lot of money to try to get information in order to anticipate what's going to happen.
If you were to use polls in a manipulative way, what would be the best sort of thing to? Because I think about the 2014 referendum, and I wonder about that yes/no poll, and how rogue it was, or whether actually you could reflect on it. And say, well, that was the perfect timing for it, because it woke people up to the fact that there was movement, that there was momentum on the yes side, but not perhaps quite enough to win. And it scared a lot of people who were undecided into thinking, actually, Scotland could be independent. On the eve of an election that was closely fought, would it be better, if you wanted to win it, would it be better to put out a poll that suggested you were going to lose, to scare your own supporters into definitely turning it out? Or is it better to appear to be ahead?
I think, by and large, I mean, if you think about the way this is done in local campaigning, by and large, you want to send the message that it's really close.
It's a two-horse race, as the Lib Dems would say.
Exactly, with all those dodgy graphs.
Yeah, Labour can't win here.
You want people to believe that it's worth them making the effort to go out and vote. So you need to, you know, your vote is going to matter, it's close, needs to be the message. I'm not sure it matters much whether you're narrowly ahead or narrowly behind. On the Scotland one, I mean, the thing is that the polls have been narrowing for a long time, and you know, we always make the point to people, it's important to remember what blunt instruments polls are. You know, the margin of error is plus or minus 3%, which is quite big in a binary proposition. In our feeling at the time, and I worked on that campaign as well, the No campaign, we've had so many polls saying it's sort of 51-49 to us. The margin of error just means we're going to get one at some point which says it's 51-49 the other way. That was bound to happen. It was just because polls scatter scatter either side of a mean, so you'd expect some to scatter the other side of a very close result. It definitely did galvanise the politicians. I think it was such an immersive experience for people of Scotland. Now, they've been living with this issue for 20 years. Yes. They've been living with it, you know, day to day for months and months and months. You know, almost every day there's a debate of some kind or other on Scottish TV or radio. There were so many polls. I think they were very clear that the race was narrowing. And, you know, the huge turnout that we saw in that referendum, I don't think that's because of that poll. I think that was going to happen anyway, because the whole country was hugely engaged. I think the decision to enfranchise 16 and 17-year-olds really helps. It took it into the schools, and kids were going home to their parents and talking about it. I think it's a very positive thing. And I'm not sure, actually, I think the politician reaction to it, I don't think, had much impact. You remember the vow, and they cancelled PMQs, and these are the three main parties came up to Scotland. But I think it looked like, and this is very much what the focus group reaction to it was at the time, it looked like what it was, which was panic.
Yes,
and it was the optics were they're taking a day trip from down there in London up here to Scotland.
Yeah,
and they're desperate, and they're going to say anything now, so we can't place any credibility on that. I think the thing which did flow probably from that poll, which crystallised the thing, was business. Very much as with the referendum, it was a very important part of the argument for the No campaign and the Scottish referendum that, you know, we're not making this up. If Scotland becomes an independent country, there will be a lot of businesses that will, and indeed have to, relocate at least some of their operations from Scotland. And businesses were understandably quite reluctant to get drawn into that. And I think that there were some businesses who had resisted, and when they saw that poll, thought, we've got no choice. And so it was followed by a period of several days where the news was dominated by just a succession of Scottish businesses saying, this isn't Project Fear, this is actually a thing. And I think that, in my view, was more significant in shifting people than the poll itself were, or the politician reaction.
I'm aware I've kept you for more than the promised hour, but there was just one last thing I wanted to talk about. It was something that I'm sure we've talked about before, but I watched a video from the Big Tent Ideas Festival, the Tory Glastonbury, and we've had Laura around on the show, and she chaired a session that you spoke in, where you talk about the axis of security and diversity, and use a fascinating phrase in it that the axis has rotated.
Yeah.
So does that mean that people are still where they are, but they've got effectively more or less affluent?
What it means is, I mean, if I use Tony Blair's language, it means that the dividing line of politics is at the moment not the economics of left and right. It's, to use his language, open versus closed. Mm. And that basically the effects of globalisation, the disruptive effects on our economy, combined with economic migration and rapid diversity of our country, accompanied by social liberalism, have driven to the surface of people's consciousness identity politics, cultural issues, which have started to make some people vote in different ways than they did before. So people who traditionally would have voted Tory for economic reasons starting to vote differently, and people who traditionally would have voted Labour for economic reasons. And we saw that very clearly in the referendum, when the centre of gravity of the Leave vote was in the bits of Britain that are defined by being very non-diverse, very white, and disproportionately rural and relatively poor, whereas the Remain vote was concentrated in the bits of Britain that are both very diverse and relatively well off. And that's a rotation which we've also seen in America. So traditionally, the centre-right centre of gravity would be the bits of a country that are both quite well off and relatively non-metropolitan, more rural, non-diverse. And the centre of gravity of the centre-left would be the bits of the country that are much more diverse, more metropolitan, but also much less well off. And those axes have rotated. So Trump won. His centre of gravity was among the bits of America that are poor and non-diverse. The Democrats won among bits of America that are well off and diverse. The same is true in France. The same is true in Italy and in Germany. The same. So people behaving differently because of cultural factors. So, for example, we know that one of the strongest differentiators between a Remain voter and a Leave voter is if you define your national identity as English rather than British, there's quite a strong probability that that you voted to leave. If you look at the votes that Labour lost between 1997, the high water mark, and 2015, the next time there's a majority government non-Labour, the vast disproportionate number of those votes they lost were people who defined their national identity as English. The vast majority of them are people who went on to vote for Brexit. So now that was happening in the background. What Brexit did was drive that to the surface. But what underpins that is that, not for everybody, but for most people on both sides, the EU referendum wasn't just a question of are we better off in or out of the European Union. It was a proxy for a wider value set, yes, for a worldview, which is hence the Tony Blair open closed language. And that's why it's been so divisive and why people are sort of so dug in, because it connects to your feelings about a whole range of other things, internationalism and immigration, but also a range of social issues. So, most people who voted for Leave, they're disproportionately likely to have more small-C conservative views on things like gay marriage and international development and crime. They're properly world views. And at the moment, those things are driving votes more than the traditional economics. So in 2017, the Conservative vote became, compared with just 2 years earlier, significantly poorer, less well-educated, even less diverse, sort of rotating down, and the Labour vote moved the other way.
So in terms of, we don't know when the next election will be, fevered speculation in the last fortnight that we might be on the brink of one next year, but who knows. In terms of how it looks for both parties then, because it seems from the outside that they're both keeping together quite different coalitions of Leave and Remain voters and both trying to appeal to both.
Yeah.
How does either one of those parties break the deadlock and get a majority? Who are the people that the Tories need to win over and who are the people that Labour need to win over?
Well, firstly, it's going to be very hard for either of them to win a majority because we're a very deeply divided country. And that rotation, that polarisation of values, which underpins it, means almost by definition, you're going to have to choose. You can't be the party of open and the party of closed. And people can tell when you're faking it, and there is a trade-off. What the Tory party has been doing over the last several years is basically trading off more liberal, middle-class voters in favour of gaining more socially conservative, more traditionally Labour voters, and that has an effect in pulling the centre of gravity of what you believe. Parties can to some extent, they need to define the shape and the size of the coalition they want to build. David Cameron drew a coalition which pulled in a lot of non-traditional Tories, a lot of former Liberal Democrats in 2015 that created a majority. In an election, remember when UKIP got 12.5% of the vote. If you told us in 2012 that UKIP will get 12.5% of the vote in the next election, we would have assumed you'd have a Labour government.
Yeah.
So he managed to win without absorbing the UKIP coalition. At the moment, the Conservative Party is redrawing a different shaped coalition that takes in a lot of UKIP voters but shuts out a lot of centre-ground voters, former Liberal Democrats, former Labour Party voters. Jeremy Corbyn, because he's somebody who doesn't represent open values, because he is at best ambivalent about the European Union, probably actually opposed to it. He believes to some extent in a closed economy because he thinks the European Union and globalisation is a capitalist conspiracy. That means that he doesn't have an easy appeal to lots of people who a centre-left party in this divide ought to be able to appeal to. So there's a hole there, and there are lots of people who don't feel that any party represents them.
Is it fair to say of Corbyn that in some ways he's closed and that in some ways he's open, or certainly could sell himself as open to younger, more idealistic people who would see his solidarity with sort of international workers and things like that as proof of openness?
Yeah, I think that's right. And in 2017, one of the reasons Labour did so well is they got away with trying to straddle it.
Yeah.
I think the more that people see of him, the more clear they are that actually he's not at all a supporter of Remain, and actually the key aspects of that whole worldview that he doesn't really share, but he has enough of it to appeal to some voters. I don't think he has enough of it to get over the line. And if you also ask yourself the question, who is going to vote Labour next time, who didn't vote Labour last time, I think that's quite a hard question to answer. whereas it's quite clear that there are people who voted Labour last time who won't vote Labour next time. So I think if you had an election now, the most likely outcome would be another messy young parliament.
Andrew, Lord Cooper, it has been an honour to have you in here. Thank you so much for giving us your time. It's flown by. Hopefully we can have a chat again at some point in the future.
Anytime.
Thank you. Well, Andrew Cooper, what a guy and what a guest. He was absolutely superb. You can follow him on Twitter at Andrew Cooper _. I imagine there's a few Andrew Coopers on there, but he's the one with the blue tick who tweets about politics if you're struggling to find him. He was so good. And what I really, apart from all the brilliant insights he gave, he wears it so lightly. Like, this is a guy who is in the House of Lords, has been Director of Strategy at Downing Street, and is so modest and approachable, where, you know, my brief career in politics, you would often get people quite pumped up on themselves who would feel very powerful with very little power and influence and very little to justify that, whereas this guy is exceptionally clever, really insightful, has served at the highest level and is just so open, which... open in perhaps a very different way to the open and closed discussion we had, although indeed perhaps not. He was great, and I need to find an excuse to get him back on in the future. So let me know what you thought. Email me at politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. If you can, leave an iTunes review. It really helps other people find it. And after all, you know, I do make this with the intent that as many people as possible can have this as a resource. I left this really feeling like I'd just... I remember when I first got into politics, where you'd read an article or you'd see an interview or you'd hear a speech by someone that really just reminded you about how brilliant politics can be, and I felt so energised after. I still do. A day later, I'm still buzzing from it. I almost feel like I've been to the cinema. You know, you feel like you've had a technicolor experience from someone. He was so good. But yes, email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. And as I said, there are shows that you can buy tickets to. Two Christmas specials at the Leicester Square Theatre with live music from the wonderful MP4. That's on the 19th and 20th of December. Big Christmas parties that we have there. They're always raucous and great fun. And I'm doing two stand-up shows. Well, I'm doing one stand-up show twice, if you see what I mean, at the South Bank Centre on the 1st and 5th of December. And then I'm going on tour next year, all around the country. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head where I'm going. I know I'm definitely doing Newcastle, Edinburgh, Glasgow, the Lowry in Salford, and various other places. So look out for those. MattFord.com/live for all the latest live dates on there. And yes, thank you so much for downloading. Do tell people about it. Get in touch with Andrew Cooper. Email me. And I'll see you next week. Thank you very much. Ta-ra.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.